for individuals interested in the medical field. Welcome to the Doc Talk Podcast, where doctors from around the world discuss groundbreaking work in the medical industry. Because in an ever-changing world, healthcare is constant.
Welcome back to the Doc Talk Podcast, and I'm super excited to interview my next speaker, Dr. Jean Techmeister. Dr. Jean Techmeister is double board certified in physical medicine, rehabilitation, and sports medicine. As a physical medicine and rehabilitation physician, his focus remains on decreasing pain and working with his patients to allow them to resume their activities. Dr. Techmeister is a physician consultant for the Los Angeles Kings professional hockey team and USC Trojans athletic medicine and team physician for the US ski and snowboard teams. His specialties include advanced interventional spine care, regenerative treatments, and sports medicine. He is at the forefront of spine research, interested in regenerative therapeutics to treat chronic lower back pain. In the time he has been a part of Keck Medicine of USC, he has brought new technologies to treat chronic lower back pain and spinal stenosis. We're so grateful to have you on board, Dr. Jean Techmeister. I'm very excited to dive deep into these questions, especially as an individual interested in athletics herself. So let's get into it. How are you doing today?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to share some knowledge and hope to bring to the forefront some things that most people may or may not know about and give some background to some of the things that we may hear on TV.
Yeah, thank you so much. So give us a little glimpse into the life of a sports medicine physician. It sounds very novel. Like, what is it like working with athletic teams? What do patient rounds look like? Conducting research, etc. Like, give us a glimpse into your daily life.
My daily life is going to be a little bit different. I do not cover games any longer. I used to, but I don't do any sideline coverage at this point in time. Having a background as an athletic trainer in undergraduate and then a little bit postgraduate, it was often travel with teams, being around athletes all the time, making sure that they are performing, prevention of injuries and things as such. And that kind of came on later and continued to do game side and sideline coverage for football, hockey, and ski and snowboard teams, mixed martial arts and things like that. So it really varies, to be honest. You know, if you're a head team doc for, let's say, the NHL Kings, like one of my partners is, who's Dr. Frank Petrigliano, who's the chief of sports medicine at USC, he covers all the home games and then he will travel with a team during playoffs. You know, the NHL has a certain set of rules that who needs to be there for every game. For example, it's a trauma surgeon, ER physician, dentist, primary care, cardiologist, orthopedic surgeon, and they require the home team to provide that. Now you go and look at something like USC, for example, and the Trojans and athletic medicine, not all the teams have a physician traveling with them. Dr. Seth Gamrat, who's the chief of sports and the medical director for athletic medicine, he travels with football. You know, one of the other associate physicians travels with basketball, but teams like lacrosse and soccer don't really have a physician that travels with them, but they do have physicians that cover the games on a daily basis. So it really varies. Are you a head team physician? Are you assistant team physician? I treat all of these patients, both from the Kings and USC Trojans and local community. So they actually come to me, you know, as a consultant and having such a niche in terms of treating low back pain, where even though it's prominent injuries that do occur, they're not as common as ankle, knee, shoulder problems. So I don't need to be on the sideline, but patients just come and see me for evaluation, second opinions, treating what my specialty is, which is spine care. And depending on where you see your life, that's kind of what you have to think about. Do you want to travel every weekend? Do you want to be close with the team, the players, the coaches, the athletic staff? Do you want to treat patients but not do sideline coverage? Do you want to do a little bit of both? There's really a lot of variety in terms of what you do. Some of the most famous sports medicine physicians don't travel with teams anymore. They're there and have athletes come to them, and some still travel because they enjoy it. So in my life, what I do on a daily basis is see patients, and probably 80, 90% of that involves treating the community, weekend warriors such as you or I. And the other, you know, 10% is caring for professionals, semi-professional and amateur athletes that come to see me with a certain problem and try to help them through it.
Yeah, thank you. That sounds fantastic. So let's talk a little bit about spine care, which is what you mentioned. And so are there any notable pharmacological interventions for that? And would you recommend just that by itself, or any hybrid interventions that would provide probably better patient outcomes?
I'm going to take a step back. Now, I'm going to answer your question, but I'm going to preface that with some statistics.
Go for it. Yeah.
And if you're looking at back pain, back pain in general is the number one leading cause of disability in the world. It is the number two cause of seeing a physician in the United States. It is prevalent, it is pervasive. Everybody's going to get back pain at some point in their lives. What you have to understand, and what most people don't understand, is 80% of these people get better with minimal or no intervention within 4 weeks with just time. So if you're able to use any kind of pain relieving tools, over-the-counter anti-inflammatories, Tylenol is a very underrated pain reliever. It really is calming the symptoms down initially so your body can facilitate its own recovery process and getting better and moving so you can do what you need to do on a daily basis. And more than, a large majority, and we're talking about 80% of people, will get better within a short period of time. We're talking about 2 to 3 weeks, 4 weeks at the most after an acute onset of lower back pain. And the role of pharmacological therapy is not to reduce the symptoms or create healing, it's to reduce pain so we can be mobile. The worst thing you can do for back pain is nothing. And it is still very dogmatic reasoning that you see in the community where somebody has an acute episode and they're told, oh, rest for a couple of days or take it easy, don't do anything. We know over the last 50 years of spine research that that's probably the worst thing you can do. You want to stay as active as possible, move as much as possible. And that's where medications orally, at least pharmacologically, come into play, where they reduce the symptoms so you can actually move and allow your body to facilitate its own regenerative process. For the 80, 20% that don't get better, then that's where we start to being more aggressive. And it's not really treating symptoms or MRIs, it's really treating patients to try and get them to be more mobile, more functional. And that's, I think, is a little bit lost when you talk about spine care in the world today. So very limited pharmacological treatments other than inducing activity. We know that there is very little role, if any, for any high potency narcotics and opioid medications. And you stick with a little bit of anti-inflammatories and Tylenol to keep you moving, and the 4 out of 5 chance that you're going to get better in a couple of weeks, just like that.
Great. So let's dive deep into research. What technological advancements has the field of sports medicine seen in the recent years that have drastically improved patient care and outcomes?
I think prevention is something that is underrated. Creating the appropriate accessory muscle activity in order to prevent injury, appropriate warm up, sports specific exercise and ability, followed by a cool down period. Not really much of an advance, but kind of more learning of what really is effective. Nutrition is absolutely monumental in what it has created, especially for elite endurance athletes. So things like cycling, for example. 20, 30 years ago, you don't want to eat a lot when you're on a bike. You want to reduce your carb load. You want to make sure your tummy feels right so you can be at your highest peak performance. Over the last couple of years, we're talking about athletes taking in 5, 6, 7,000 calories, majority of carbohydrates, lactate threshold. So peak performance in terms of athletics has really seen a dramatic change in terms of how do we optimize function in a very high level. Now, as far as treatments go, there has been some ablation treatments that help with axial low back pain. It's called basivertebral nerve ablation. There are some other technical advancements that help manage certain symptoms. I don't think, to be honest, there has anything been really earth-shattering in sports medicine in recent years. I think we've gotten a lot better at helping people through an injury in terms of getting the back, but nothing that's going to get somebody better that much quicker than what we have seen. We're just better at it.
I see. That's great. So I wanted to dive a little deeper into treatments. And the first treatment that I wanted to discuss was intradiscal stem cell injections, because you mentioned that you work in regenerative therapeutics. How does it treat chronic back pain?
So stem cells don't, as of this point, as of the recording of this episode, there is no randomized controlled high-level studies that show that stem cells are effective in the intradiscal space. Now, there are two studies. They're both from, I think, like 19, 2019, 2020. They're looking intradiscal PRP. PRP stands for platelet-rich plasma. What that does is we take your blood, we spin it down, we extract the platelets, which is a component of a blood product. We leave the white blood cells and the red blood cells, and we take those platelets and we inject that into an injured tissue. The mechanism behind that is platelets is what creates scabs, is what heals cuts and wounds. So if there's an injured disc, the theory is that if we inject a concentrated platelet product, we can heal a disc tear, we can help that seal or coagulate and regenerate. We know that that doesn't exactly work that way. It's mostly a pain reliever and an anti-inflammatory tool. And I think the true mechanics and the machinery behind how these regenerative treatments work are still lacking. We introduce a stem cell to an injured body part, but we don't know what actually happens. We know that these stem cells can potentially progress to create a disc cell, a cartilage cell, or ACL cell, or a ligament cell, but we have no way of controlling that process. We just inject it and hope it works. We don't really have proof at this point in time of true tissue healing. We have evidence that it does help with pain, it does help with function, it does help reduce mortality, morbidity when it comes to musculoskeletal diseases, but we don't have any in vivo evidence to show that we can actually reverse any kind of tissue damage. We can halt it or stop it. And like I said, the only two randomized control studies looking at PRP intradiscally, there is no randomized control studies looking at stem cells. I think the missing link is an activation factor. If we can take a stem cell, put that back into an injured tissue to make sure that stem cell actually continues to progress to become that injured tissue cell. But at this point in time, we have no control over that. And I think that is the missing piece. So that's an incredibly deep question in terms of how does this actually work? Well, we don't know. We hope it works, but we're just not there yet and trying to figure out how do we control that process.
Very fascinating. I had no idea about that. But let's move on to the next type of treatment mechanism, which is radiofrequency neurotomy. What is this and what is its effectiveness? Would you recommend it?
Yeah, absolutely. Neurotomy is another word for ablation. Ablation is a heated killing off, burning, cauterization on of a nerve for the purpose of reversing, improving, or halting a certain unwanted function. Now, this technology has been used for 50, 60 years for cardiac ablations, cryoablations to reduce tumor sizes and things like that. In the spine world, we use radiofrequency ablation or neurotomy to stop painful signals traveling up into the brain. And there are two major procedures that we do. One is in the posterior part of the spine, which is of the facet joints. The facet joints are these joints in the spine on either side. They act as hinges, which allow the spine to be mobile. They allow you to bend and flex and rotate. And what we do is we can find this painful joint. We just stop the pain signal from that joint so you can continue to function. And the good news is that that nerve doesn't really have much of anything else that it does other than creating that pain signal. So if we start that pain, stop that pain signal from that painful arthritic joint, which we don't really have any other treatment for, then patients can go on and continue functioning normally and hope to regain some control of their quality of life and their ability to do things. And the second ablation technique, which is newer, it became FDA approved 2 years ago in 2022. And it's a procedure called basovertebral nerve ablation, or BVN for short. The basovertebral nerve is the nerve that goes into the bone over the vertebral bodies in the front part of the spinal canal. And that nerve generates or transfers pain signals from a painful, what's called end plate. Your disc is attached to the end plate above and below into the vertebral body. So that nerve controls that signal. So what we can do is we can stop that signal from a painful disc. And what's marvelous about this procedure is it's a treatment for a problem that we have not had a treatment for in the past. If somebody just has low back pain, spine surgery is not indicated. Lumbar disc replacements are not where we need it to be. We used to fuse these patients, and that's really not indicated for low back pain because surgery for lower back pain is very hit or miss. So now we have this targeted treatment that is able to deaden the nerve that's responsible for disc or vertebral end plate problem that we can measure by a MRI biomarker and now have a treatment for something that we haven't had in before. So an ablation or a neurotomy procedure is incredibly, incredibly useful in treating back pain when we know what the source is, and we know if we stop that pain signal, patients don't have pain and are able to resume normal function with really very little sequela. Don't deaden the nerve that goes to the legs, or you don't deaden or anything else other than that pain source. So it would be very, very targeted to stop the pain, but not have any other effect that nerve may carry. So if you're, for example, going to hurt yourself in the future, you're going to feel it, you're going to lose any sensation, you don't lose any function or motor control, but you just feel less pain. And it's a great advancement because it's minimally invasive. It's done via needle technique that's hooked up to a machine that generates a radio frequency signal. And the tip of that needle gets heated to 80, 90 degrees Celsius, which, again, for lack of a better word, just kind of cauterizes that nerve ending and allows for pain relief.
It's very fascinating, especially the research that goes into these novel techniques. So one of the other techniques that I had read about was a discectomy, which is a procedure to remove all or part of a bulging or herniated disc. So what are the pros and cons of such a procedure?
First thing is, it's not for treating back pain. You know, if you have back pain, it's maybe the disc that's involved, but we do not do surgery for in the microdiscectomy for back pain. The reason for doing a microdiscectomy or any other kind of disc surgery is to reduce the pressure that that part of the disc is putting on the nerve, and you're getting leg pain. And that's called radiculopathy or sciatica. So when you have a herniated disc and it creates an impingement on the nerve, that's what we're really treating, is that impingement by taking a piece that puts the pressure on the nerve. We know based on, you know, evidence that doing a discectomy for back pain is not very effective because it doesn't really get rid of the back pain. That's not really what it's designed to do. But if you have a herniated disc that's pinching the nerve and you're getting pain down the leg or getting pain, you know, that's radiating with numbness, tingling, or weakness, the most important part is getting pressure off of that nerve. And that's what the discectomy is designed to do. And there are recently developed techniques that are even less invasive. You know, one of my partners here at USC and at our spine center, they do this endoscopic discectomy, tubular discectomy, which are done through a tiny, tiny incision with minimum manipulation of the tissue, much quicker recovery, and the outcomes being largely the same, but with all the added benefits of doing something that's incredibly less invasive. So you just put in, you know, a tube that's maybe the size of a highlighter all the way down to where you need to be. You could directly visualize the disc, you could take it out, you could pull it out, and it's a percutaneous procedure that doesn't have to be done open with a large incision. And I think going back to your earlier question about advancements, now, while we're talking about spine care and not necessarily just sports medicine, but that's what we really got it good at in terms of spine care, is doing more with less and really minimizing collateral tissue damage by treating something that we know is painful and optimizing recovery. We see similar things that have been advanced, for example, in total hip arthroplasty. You know, the anterior approach versus the posterior approach, for example, has been shown to allow for quicker recovery, lower dislocation rates, and a bunch of other advancements and benefits through an approach that can do the same thing, but with less tissue manipulation and less tissue damage.
Great. Thank you so much for that. And I wanted to focus a little more on compression of the back. And so for the sake of the audience, could you describe what spinal stenosis is and share information about any technologies you use to treat the same?
Sure. Spinal stenosis is the fastest growing reason for having surgery in the United States for those over the age of 65. And what spinal stenosis is a narrowing of the spinal canal as we age because of arthritis, genetics, maybe an old disc injury and things like that. And it's a narrowing and a congestion that traps the nerve roots. The analogy that I'll always use when talking to patients about spinal stenosis is if you have a four-lane highway and you have a lane closed. Now, you have still lanes open, so that nerve is being able to send the signals through the spinal canal to your legs and your feet so you can walk and do whatever you need to do. But if you're very active or if it's a busy time, that's like 3 o'clock on a Friday, that one lane being closed will create an impact and a bottleneck that's going to slow traffic. And that's what is relay to your brain as pain because the nerves slow down in this area of congestion. If it's 3 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday and you're not doing a lot, then the nerves are going to be firing fine. You're not going to have pain because you're laying down, you're sitting down. But once you're upright and moving and walking, that compression increases, that narrowing increases, and your pain is increased because the nerves feel like they're not firing or transferring that signal as fast as they should. And that's going to be picked up by your brain as pain to tell your body that something is wrong. The mainstay of treatment for lumbar spinal stenosis, like with everything else, is really conservative. Most people get better with physical therapy, some medications, activity modifications, strength training, and such. Some may benefit from an injection to calm the symptoms down so they become active. And then there's a minimally invasive surgical procedures, things like interspinous process decompression. Interspinous process decompression is a little metal piece that gets inserted between the bones to help relieve the pressure from that compression and allow patients to return to function. Then there's open laminectomy, which is removal of what is creating that compression. That's called a laminectomy. So you take off bone that's on top of the spinal canal to allow for more space for those nerves. Then there is fusion and MIS decompression. At the end of the day, the surgical and interventional treatment for spinal stenosis has to involve what's called decompression, literally decompressing the area that's congested so the nerves have more room, so they're not in pain when they're being in an area of narrowing.
That's great. I think a lot of what you've spoken about just, places a lot of emphasis on prevention rather than looking at like the mere symptoms of all these issues. So tell us how pursuing a DO degree helped you become the sports medicine physician that you are today. For the audience, a DO is a doctor of osteopathic medicine. It's the same as an MD. So how did doing a DO degree, help with your career?
I think being an osteopathic physician and pursuing a DO is really rooted in the fact that there was, additional training in musculoskeletal medicine, hands-on approaches, tactile feeling. While some of the techniques are really evidence-based, some are more traditional and maybe a little bit dogmatic. So you have to really evaluate what the tools are. But as an osteopathic physician, that extra and additional training in manual manipulative medicine, getting your hands on patients early, feeling tissue texture changes, feeling abnormal sense of skin and muscle changes really help to add a tool to what I have in terms of treating athletes. Anybody can be a sports medicine physician as long as you have a medical degree, obviously an MD or a DO. It's just in terms of how you want to go and pursue that. I think in today's day and age, in 2024, the postgraduate training is the same. There's one match. There's no disassociation anymore between the allopathic and the osteopathic residency or transitional programs. Even the testing is very much the same. DO at this point in time, I believe, in my opinion anyway, is more of a historical event because it was founded by a gentleman, A.T. Still, who didn't think that traditional allopathic medicine 200 years ago was enough, and he wanted to see what else can be done. Any which way you want to pursue a medical degree is going to be sufficient in being able to become a sports medicine physician.
Perfect. Thank you. Last but not least, what do you like to do for fun, and how do you balance the stress that comes with medicine and your social life?
I'm a very outdoors person, so anything that I can do outdoors. My three favorite things to do outdoors, in no apparent order, would be skiing, cycling, and scuba diving. If I could be outside in the mountain, I would probably 250 days a year, and then probably go and be on my bike the other, 100 days and be underwater a couple days here and there. And the balance to that is my family. We go out, we hike, we go skiing together. I have a trailer that I put my little one in, and my 6-year-old can ride a bike. So we just go out and do things as a family, and just trying to get outside as much as we can. I'm in an office 3 days a week where I don't have any windows. And that's when I see patients at the Toyota Sports Center, which is the King's Practice facility in El Segundo. And needing a little vitamin D is a great motivational factor in getting out. And if I can spend my time outside, that's how I de-stress. And the way I prepare myself for that is by being active every day. I'm indoor on my bike 2 to 3 days a week. I lift weights several days a week. It's preparing myself for those things that I enjoy doing. And involving my family is in one of them. I just came back from a ski trip recently, and I was talking to a buddy of mine, and he said something interesting because he has 4 kids, and he's like, "Well, I couldn't find any buddies to ski with, so I just made my own." And he literally made his own, ski buddies and his kids that he taught to ski, and had to go out as a family. And I liked how that sounded, so I'm going to adopt it. But my 6-year-old skis; she knows how to ride a bike. My almost 2-year-old, I'm going to put up on skis probably in the next couple of weeks here. And he's already on a balance bike. So just introducing the outdoors. There's a slogan by one retail company here, outside is free. And you don't have to do anything. You just go out for a hike. We live in Southern California. We just go for a walk. It really is as simple as that.
That is so beautifully articulated and extremely refreshing to hear. Thank you so much for that. And do you have any last comments to share with the pre-med community and or the general public?
I think the biggest piece of advice I have for anybody is that if you're looking for the fountain of youth, that can be found in dumbbells. That's resistance training, that's weight training. We lose our ability to be high-level endurance athletes as we age because of reduced cardiac output or reduced heart rate potential and things like that. And we tend to lose anywhere from 8 to 10% of our muscle mass per decade after the age of 50. And that can be reduced by a factor of 10. Sarcopenia, loss of muscle mass, is a significant determinant of poor outcome. And if we can maintain a high level of strength and muscle activity throughout our life, it's as close to a fountain of youth as you can find. So if you could pick up a band, a pair of dumbbells, a dumbbell, it's incredibly important. It's vital to maintain strength throughout your life. I'm 42 years old. I have 2 kids. I work out because I want to be able to get up out of a chair when I'm 70 without using my arms. I want to be able to ski after I retire. I want to be able to play with my kids and still dominate them athletically. And that is done by working out. It's done by strength training. It cannot be understated or underestimated in how effective of a tool strength and resistance training is in preventing injury, in optimizing function, and in living a healthy life. And when somebody tells you weightlifting is a dangerous sport, rates of injury weightlifting are below that of some other common sports, including tennis and golf. And if you really want to be strong, if you want to live a full and healthy life, I have no better recommendation than weightlifting and strength training to some degree.
Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Jean Techmeister, and I could not thank you enough for taking the time out to share this lovely information with pre-med community and the general public. Thank you.
I appreciate your time, and thank you for having me on. It was a pleasure.